The next day, the funeral director called Marcy's daughter and said, "Did your mom have a thing about bees?" And she said, "Why?" "Well, when we opened up the bedding, a swarm of bees flew out." Now, I peeled those flower petals. There was no way there was a bee in there or a swarm of them. And her daughter said, "You know, now that you mention it, she lived in a house once that had a kitchen window, and she said a bee would come and visit her. In fact, she would let it in, and she said it let her pet it." Miracle. Mystery. There's no explanation for that. It was the AIDS epidemic that did it for me. Actually, even before that, I got married in 1975 to a lovely man. We were terribly in love, and he'd been gay all of his life. He was 37. But before we met, he wanted to change his life. And I walked into a straight bar one night, and we met. We fell in love. We lived together. We got married. And then we got divorced. He got depressed. We got divorced. He wasn't living his authentic life. And he moved to California from Chicago. And it was before the internet, no emails. So we would send cards once in a while. And I got a call one day that he was dying, and he was asking for me. And this is 1988. I'd already known about AIDS because I worked in the Chicago Merchandise Mart, and I was in a home fashion industry full of creative people, and a lot of them were gay men. So I had loads of gay friends. So when I got the call, it was life-changing is what it was. And I was deciding what to do. Should I go or not? You know, he was skinny. It had gotten into his brain. He was in the hospital. And just as I was trying to discern what to do, he died. And I said to myself, no one who wants me with them when they're dying, because I knew a lot of my other gay friends were going to be dying. It was happening. You got AIDS and you died then. So that was just a promise I made. Yeah, honoring my close relationships. And then by 1989, when I turned 40, I'd been to a dozen funerals or memorial services already for men I cared about. And there were more around the country I didn't even, you know, attend. Two of my best friends, men, became positive in 1987. And I just knew that we all thought they were going to be dying within a few years. So I started volunteering on the AIDS ward at a hospital in Chicago. But I learned there because it was AIDS, and the AIDS community supported each other. But in the AIDS community, everybody was young. A lot of them had partners. They certainly had a lot of friends, because in the 80s, it was still a pretty closed community, 80s and 90s. And so there was a lot of support. The doctors were gay. Some of the nurses were, not all. And I remember the first day I showed up for volunteer work, I was shaking hands, introducing myself to everybody. And this was 1995. And I came up to one of the aides. And, you know, the aides are the people who wash people, and they clean the bedpans, and they do the hard work. But they're also the closest to the patients. And usually they engage more easily in a relationship with the housekeepers than they do the doctors and the nurses. Although this unit was so friendly, and people kept coming back. That was the other thing. They'd get well, they'd go out, they'd come back, they'd die. And I came up to Linda, and I started to shake her hand, and she was from the South. And she said, "Honey, we hug here." And she wrapped her arms around me, and I could smell dusting powder on her. And she was soft and warm and a little bit shorter than I was. And I just felt so safe standing in the suffering of other people. That's what our healthcare workers do every day. And that's why so many of us are afraid to touch dying. It is the ultimate suffering. Not only are we suffering physically, which most of us do before we die, we're suffering spiritually and emotionally and psychologically. It's this whole stew of the unknown, of mystery.
And I think one of the goals should be to make that mystery sacred and a beautiful process instead of something to be scared of.
And so many of us are afraid of afterlife. I've supported a lot of Catholic nuns through death. I got attached to a particular community 20 years ago through hospice volunteering, actually. And a lot of them take a really long time to die. And I'm not sure if it's, I mean, you know, they spend their whole lives kind of married to God and not eager to take his hand to cross over the veil. It's fascinating to me. And I've had some of them say really strange things about death, not positive.
When I was a kid, I would help my mom in the garden. And so it was always this huge production, having to go to the nursery and getting these flats and flats of flowers and then dragging them into the yard and planting them. And so at an early age, I learned the terms annual and perennial. And I always thought, why, oh, why would there be anything that's an annual? Because it seems wasteful to me. But, you know, after a while, I thought maybe it's to teach us about the brevity of life, you know, that you're here to shine for one moment and your brilliance then fades away. But I thought to myself when I was a kid, are we annuals or are we perennials? And it has haunted me since I've thought of it. And I have come to the conclusion that we are perennials. That is what I think.
I had a woman at the nursing home that became our friend when mom was still alive. They were both in hospice at the same time. And she had had Parkinson's for 25 years and her last 10 were not easy, but she was always in a good mood. How you doing, Marcy? Good, good. And she took a walk. She was also in hospice off and on. And in the last few days of her life, her daughters and I were sitting vigil with her. And the night she died at the nursing home, I was actually staying in my mom's room. And I went into Marcy's room and I said, hey, call her daughters. She's changing. I could see she was starting to model where the blood lays in the hands and the feet, because it's not circulating anymore. And they came over and we're in this double room and we're squeezed between the wall. One of them's at the wall trying to hold their mom's hand, hard to do. And the other one is up against the curtain to the roommate trying to hold her mom's other hand. And I'm at the foot of the bed and we're chit-chatting. And all of a sudden I looked at Marcy and she wasn't breathing. We didn't even notice her last breath. It was so quiet. We didn't notice it. And one of the daughters looked over and said to her mother, good job, mom. And I said, we have to do something. And by then it was 10 in the morning. They'd been there all night. Good job, mom. And I went around and the nurse came in and cleaned her up. And the daughters and I went around and we told all the other residents, if they wanted to come in and say goodbye, they could do that. And I went to my mother's room and I always had flowers in her room and I got a Kleenex box and I pulled all the petals off the flowers in her bouquet and I put them in the Kleenex box, went back to Marcy's room. And as people came in, I said, take some flowers and put them on her bed as your last gift to her. And this went on for like an hour. Residents, nurses came in. And when everybody was done, Marcy's bed was covered in flower petals, which is what the last thing her daughters saw before the funeral director came. And they wrap all the bedding around the body and put it in a plastic bag. Unfortunately, we weren't tuned in then. I recommend nursing homes get some sort of a comforter to cover the plastic bag. Some of them make quilts to cover the bag so that when it leaves the nursing home, it can go out the front door instead of the back door. And it doesn't look like a body bag like you see on a police picture. The next day, the funeral director called Marcy's daughter and said, did your mom have a thing about bees? And she said, why? Well, when we opened up the bedding, a swarm of bees flew out. Now, I peeled those flower petals. There was no way there was a bee in there or a swarm of them. And her daughter said, you know, now that you mention it, she lived in a house once that had a kitchen window. And she said a bee would come and visit her. In fact, she would let it in. And she said it let her pet it. Miracle. Mystery. There's no explanation for that.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Bite Size Blessings. Episode 54 is a special one for me. I have been interested in learning more about death and having those conversations around a topic so considered taboo, so I was very grateful when Loretta Downs said that she'd be a guest on my show. I hope that you found this conversation as helpful as I have, and I look forward to having other guests and having more conversations around this topic. I need to thank Loretta for her wise and wonderful words and her compassionate heart. I also need to thank the creators of the music used, Winnie the Moog, Agnes Filmagia, Music L Files, Chilled Music, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to other episodes, books, music, and changemakers I hope will lift and inspire you. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Loretta, and remember that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And at the end of each of our lives, what does a good death look like? Does it look like medicines and machines being used to prolong and extract every drop of life that we can possibly have? Or does it look like quietness, being surrounded by family and friends, being surrounded by people who love you, and being held in their arms and in that space so that we can have a good death, one that is filled with love, one that is filled with humility, and one that is filled with the knowledge that it is only the beginning of a grander adventure.